There are many things going on in the news at the moment, and I think it's certainly worthwhile going through some of them at any rate. My problem is really to sort out what to leave out and what to leave in. But certainly this coming Tuesday, I believe it is, the United States goes to the polls. And there are certain articles in the press over here in the UK, and certainly one that appeared, I think it was today, yes, today, today's comment on the actual polls. It says, Armageddon warning, as the polls point to a result the losers will not accept. In other words, it's the problem is that they are so closely tied together. Remember what happened last? There's all this legal contention that took place at the elections. It made a mockery of democracy. And it says the United States is facing an Armageddon, in quotes, election result in which a dangerous number of people refuse to accept the winner as their legitimate leader, a leading pollster warned yesterday. With votes as closely divided as they were in the last days of the 2000 campaign, the two parties will head to the polls next Tuesday angrier and more suspicious of each other than at any other time in polling history. So I think that's a worthwhile comment. I won't read the entire article, but certainly it's a worthwhile comment, because it gives the idea and it gives the impression of a very uncertain world. And there is a polarity there between the two candidates, and there's no love lost between the two. Not between the two, but between the two groups of people, the supporters of the two candidates. And the interesting thing was that this morning, that we find that Osama bin Laden suddenly reappears, and he gave this videotape that was played on the Arab television, and he is perfectly, obviously, well, he is obviously alive, because he's commenting about the election, he's commenting specifically about the two candidates in the election. And this, again, it is interesting what he has to say. Now, I don't have anything written on what he has to say, but what he was basically saying, from what I can remember of the news item I heard this morning, he says that the countries within Europe, such as Sweden, which have certain foreign policies which are not against the Arab world, they will completely leave alone. But countries that have any foreign policies that are against the Arab world, i.e. America and Britain and so on, then there will be foreign policies from the Arab world against them, or specifically from Al-Qaeda against them. And it was quite chilling. It was apparently rambling. They try and give this spin on it. But it also comes at a time which... there's an article here from last Sabbath's paper. It says that Bush was wrong on the Al-Qaeda hunt. It says a central plank of the Bush administration's war on terrorism, a relentless global manhunt hunt for Al-Qaeda leaders, came under extraordinary attack yesterday from the U.S. counter-terrorist chiefs, both past and present. It says President George Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and senior aides have grossly exaggerated the success of their decapitation strategy on the election trail, according to serving and recently retired intelligence and military officials interviewed by the Washington Post. The source also said that a wider fight for the hearts and mind of the Muslim world has been disastrously ignored in favor of a single-minded focus on finding a hard core of known Al-Qaeda leaders. Now, this focus goes in also into the Kerry camp as well. And he goes in and he says, yesterday, as he has done almost every day for weeks, Mr. Bush said that a large majority of Al-Qaeda leaders had been neutralized. In Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Mr. Bush said that we are staying on the offensive and we are succeeding. More than three-quarters of Al-Qaeda key members and associates have been brought to justice, and the rest of them know that we're after them. But classified data leaked to the Washington Post indicates that only 14 of the roughly 30 high-value targets have actually been killed or captured. So most of them are still out there. And certainly the key one, which was as far as Osama bin Laden, he has not only been out there, but now is very, very clearly out there commenting on the actual elections themselves. And it gives this uncertainty. It's some uncertainty in the world. And this really is, if you like, there's a theme of the news, that we are entering a time of uncertainty. it is interesting as well when we look at the times that we are in and we're just going into now. Come January, we are entering 19 years from the death of Mr. Armstrong. Now, in the world, nobody has any idea that that might be significant. Within the church, we should at least realise that it could well be significant. I'm not saying that it definitely is, but it could well be. It's certainly that God does work within 19-year time cycles. And when we look at the significance of that individual and the revelation that was given to that individual, we within the church should at least recognise that this is a key benchmark in God's eyes coming up in January. And the lead up to it, we're looking now at quite an uncertain world. In commenting about this US election, just turn over to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. In Isaiah 40, it talks about, comfort you my people, verse 1 says, your God, speak comfortably to Jerusalem. And again, Jerusalem, Zion is the church, and so often in Isaiah, Jerusalem are those associated with the church. And cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received of the Eternal's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that cries in the wilderness, prepare a way of the Eternal, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. And that's going to have to happen. The temple is going to have to be built, a spiritual temple to which Christ is going to return. Every valley shall be exalted. Every mountain and hill is going to be made low. And this process that we're looking at, if this is true, that as it mentions in this article that I read at the beginning, that it's an Armageddon warning, as the polls point to a result the losers will all not accept. It again shows a mockery of democracy, and all the churches that have accepted democracy need to look at that and realize that God's hand is firmly behind that, if that is the case, that he certainly allows it. And it is showing that democracy is an unworkable solution. And when you have two candidates and one gets in under much protest and confrontation, and then half the country doesn't want that particular individual in, that is not a rulership by the people at all. It just isn't. Whatever they try and what kind of spin they try and put onto it, it isn't. When we come across to Europe, so it says here in verse 4, it says that every mountain and hill should be made low, and the crooked made straight, and so on. And it is Zion who, in fact, I'm not going to have time to read it all, but it shows that man and all his systems are basically just like grass. They're going to be rotten, they'll decay, they'll disappear. And the only thing that's going to be of lasting value and benefit is Zion, are the things that God has placed within his people. And that's why it's comfort to his people. And we need to understand that when we watch the election results. If it is chaos, then okay, fine. It's not there. That's not where it's at. And when we look across at the other big event that occurred yesterday, and it is a big event that occurred yesterday, which was the signing of the European Constitution, again, we see chaos. We see uncertainty. We see confrontation between various parties. But just a comment here from today's paper, from the actual editorial comment. It says, like most things in the EU, it's crept up on us. For years, the EU was only an economic community. Justice and Home Affairs first feature in EU treaties with Maastricht in 1991, and have been moving forward ever since. But now we have such ideas as the Common European Arrest Warrant and Common Asylum Policy. We are also moving towards a pan-European prosecuting magistratory and the granting of executive powers in Europol, which is supposed to be no more than a body of police and cooperation rather than a European police force, but you can guarantee where it's going to lead. Most of these powers, in fact, are not in the treaties. They are simply pushed forward on the basis of summit communiques and such like. But they will be cemented by the European Constitution and the Charter of Fundamental Rights contained within it. When the European Parliament recently interviewed all 25 potential commissioners, it asked each whether he or she would feel free to implement their bits of the European Constitution now, without waiting for the national referendums and ratifications on the subject. Only 6 out of the 25 said that they should wait. One of the 19 who wanted to go ahead without democratic approval was Mr. Buttiglione, which is the one who all the problems are about, where his comments about homosexuality and women that have made the great furore within the European Union. On the same, again, on the opposite page of today's paper, it says, Rome may prove to be fatal for another leader. It says, what was going through Tony Blair's mind yesterday as he signed the EU constitution on Rome's Capitoline Hill? It says, formerly the site of the Temple of Jupiter, which is interesting. In a sense, the setting was appropriate, for the document nurtures imperial pretensions. As Charles Moore pointed out in the facing page, the constitution will resoundingly assert, in law, the EU's primacy over Britain. And yet there's also something incongruous about the signing of this document in the splendid Renaissance Hall where the Treaty of Rome was concluded in 1957. The original treaty was conceived by idealists who knew exactly what they were trying to achieve. Its objectives were limited and unambiguous. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing's constitution is in an utter mess whose ill-drafted obfuscations almost but not quite conceal its federalist agenda. Although he has not had the guts to admit much, Mr. Blair must know that it's a bad document, and for that reason alone, his pen must have hovered over it yesterday. Now, you might think, well, if it's a bad document, then that's all right then. Well, no, it's not, and this is the problem. The article on the 29th, yesterday, wasn't it? It says, if you want to know, and this is again the comment within the paper, it says, if you want to know why the European Constitution is a bad idea, then just read it. This is not as easy as it sounds. I recommend that if you're going to try, you should arm yourself with a packet of Pro Plus and a bottle of Prozac. The caffeine will help you keep awake through 350 pages of turgid legalese, and the Prozac might stave off the depression that'll descend when you realise that so many of our liberties are being thrown away. And it goes on in this article, it says, the language is deliberately ambiguous, it's stuffed with contradictory objectives, and the lack of clarity is summed up by the Orwellian motto the Constitution wants to put into law, unity in diversity. You know, doublespeak. It says, however, it leaves no room for doubt in one vital respect, it would transfer even more power to the EU. Because the Constitution contains so many new powers for the EU and is so vague, many vital issues will be resolved only when the European Court of Justice rules on how it should be interpreted. Now, do you see why it's a bad document? It's not a case that it's just obfuscated and you can't really understand what it's actually saying. It's deliberately that way so that the real policy will be decided within European courts, and the European courts have been placed into effect. So we see this devious, snake-like approach that is occurring within Europe, and we shouldn't be surprised because we know where it's coming from. It's coming from a devious, snake-like, serpentine approach, and it's going to be the final resurrection, ultimately, of a devious serpentine approach within this world. So it says, they resolve only when the European Court of Justice rules on how it should be interpreted. For this reason, the Constitution is the politica equivalent of a blank check. Its full implications will become clear only once after it has been ratified. The Constitution is meant to set out precisely what powers lie within a governing administration, but the EU Constitution defines most powers as shared between member states and the EU, and it goes on to define shared as meaning member states can act only if Europe has chosen not to. Member states can only act if Europe chooses not to. He says, this is an extraordinary proposal. It's like some dodgy timeshare in which the salesman, that's a timeshare property, when the salesman tells you that you can use your new place in the sun whenever we don't want it. That's really what he's saying. In other words, you can only do this if we don't want to. And it is that type of construction that really gives the danger within the entire document that's just been signed yesterday. And it's something that we certainly do need to watch. We need to realise where it's actually come from, and we just need to keep an eye firmly on the situation there. Now, one thing that has happened also this past week is that there was a climb down by Europe, by Barroso. It says, faced with certain defeat by an angry Europe MPs, Manuel Barroso yesterday withdrew his embattled team of European commissioners in a historic upset that profoundly alters the character of the European Union. In other words, the MPs who were elected to the post, albeit in a very, very an election where the population really doesn't tend to take part. I mean, the European elections don't have much. You don't even know they're going on, in many cases. I think, what's the percentage? It's about 30%, something like that, of the populace that actually elects the Euro MPs, because nobody else is interested in it. But they have gone ahead and put their stamp on the fact that the Commission, which are unelected officials that have been appointed by each individual member state, are not going to be acceptable. Now, the reason for this is because of this particular man called I can never pronounce his name. It's Rocco Bertiglione, and he basically has said that homosexuality is a sin and women should be in the home, and that has caused such a furore that they've actually stopped the commissioners from being put into place. And he said this will not affect his actual administration. He's only going to go ahead. This is a personal view, and he doesn't feel that it's going to actually affect his administration at all in the post. But he has actually been turned down. It's interesting. In the same article, this was what was this? 28. That's 2 days ago. It says the Euro-socialists feel betrayed by Mandelson. It says Peter Mandelson was accused yesterday of double dealing and snitching on colleagues in the frenetic scramble to save the doomed commission team of Barroso. It says, Mr. Mandelson is alleged to have slipped out of a crucial make-or-break meeting of the 200-strong socialist bloc on Tuesday night to make a series of hurried telephone calls to the Barroso team disclosing what had occurred in confidential talks behind closed doors. And he goes on, it says, the former Labour spin doctor, which is what Mr. Mandelson was, allegedly told his fellow socialists that he favoured action to strip Mr. Bertiglione of the justice portfolio, even as he continued to tell conservatives that he was full square behind the beleaguered Italian. Now, the interesting thing is that Mr. Mandelson is an outright homosexual, and he's openly homosexual, and I think you see, to some degree, I wouldn't say that's why he's you know, dealing in that way, but it is interesting that is the case, and he's double dealing, and you know, it's a corrupt system, it's a corrupt government, it's going to be a corrupt government in the future. In fact, it's going to be an awful lot worse than even what we've got at the moment. But you know, we in patience possess our souls. We understand God is a God of vengeance. He will sort it out. And those that lead into captivity will go into captivity, and this is the patience we've got to have as we move into the future. On the 23rd of October, there's an article calling about difference between law and morality, and again commenting on Mr. Bertiglione's problem. It says, part of Mr. Bertiglione's problem is that he's a Roman Catholic. If, let's say, a Muslim nominee had told the inquisitors that although he regarded the Holy Quran as revelation of divine will, he would have nonetheless respect the laws and customs of the EU, he would have been applauded as an example of successful assimilation, and rightly so. But anti-Catholicism remains a powerful force for many southern European left-wingers. This is where it's coming from. It's a southern European left-wing. Now, why is it left-wing? Because they're reacting against the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has certain morality and values. And they've held control for so long that here's now the left-wing's moment and time has come. It says, their parties were reared on the struggle against what they saw as feudal superstition. Several socialist MEPs have plainly taken the view that Mr. Bertiglione is an incarnation of the reactionary clerical order that their ideological forebears fought against. It goes on, it says, what seems most confused and most puzzling is the position of those MEPs who object to Mr. Bertiglione on the grounds of anti-discrimination. the most prominent of whom is a British Lib Dem called Baroness Ludford. These politicians have repeatedly called for discrimination on grounds of religious conviction to be outlawed, and have inserted a clause to this effect in the EU's Charter of Fundamental Rights, and yet they plainly do not intend to abide by the principles that they're imposing on everybody else. Because, you see, it is morality of a quote, Christian kind. Now, when you see what actually is going to happen, and we understand that what actually is going to happen is that the religious side is going to be dominant, ultimately, then it's almost ironic what's actually taking place at the moment. But if you look at certain other articles as well, there's one here from the 26th, The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea. It says, when I joined the RAF for my national service in 1949, I had to fill in a card stating my name, service number and religion, and most of my fellow recruits were of Church of England, but since I wanted to get out of church parades, I put RC. And when somebody asked me if I was born a Catholic or was a convert, I said jokingly, in fact, I'm a devil worshipper, but they won't let you say that. And after that word got around, it was called in and really put on the carpet for even saying that. But there has just been a devil worshipper in the service of the submarine service who has been granted his own prayer booth for setting up his idols and all the rest of the thing. Because you can't have religious discrimination. And at the same time, anybody that says homosexuality is wrong, oh, we can't have that. You know, there's this completely warped and twisted view of so many things that are actually taking place, and we watch and we realise that he who leads into captivity is going to go into captivity, and people are being led into captivity, not just physical captivity when we're looking at the future. They're being led into mental captivity right now. And this, we've got to understand that these people that lead these people into captivity are going to go into captivity themselves. What will arise in Europe will be so bad, and they will have no say over it. All of the problems that they... and there will be a sequence of events which will lead to that. Another one, it says, a French finance minister wants state funding for mosques. It says, a state funding for mosques to counter attempts by extremists to indoctrinate young people on Muslim-dominated areas is urged today by France's most talked-about politician, the finance minister, Nicolas Sarkozy. He says in a new book, and he goes into the new book, basically what he's saying is that because we don't want the Muslim to go underground and meet in houses and homes and cellars and basements, and therefore we got this underground organization, we build mosques and make sure everybody worships in the mosque. And you see where that is leading. You see how they, in other words, you've got an approved religious group. You can control approved religious group, but you can't control the cellars and basements. It says it's not minarets that were dangerous, but the cellars and garages concealing clandestine religious groups, he says. Particularly farms in Wales. We laugh. We may laugh. But it is. That is where it's leading. That's where this... what we're looking at now is leading to, and we must be aware of where it is actually leading to. Let's just turn over to Revelation 13. Let's just remind ourselves of this again, because there's another article here from October the 24th that talks about compulsory ID cards to be issued within 4 years. Now, they've been talking about that for some considerable time. It says, compulsory identity cards that can be used as a travel document in Europe are to be introduced within 4 years under a revised scheme published yesterday by David Lunkett, the Home Secretary, and it will be backed by a national register containing personal information about card holders, and the online database will hold an audit log detailing every occasion on which an individual's record has been checked. In other words, they can have a total control, and you've got to carry this thing with you. They'll have a chip on there, and they can then read whatever it is being verified. Now, as I've pointed out numerous times, there is a certain dictatorial nature of the legislation that's taking place. At the moment, it's in amongst all this riffraff, this flack of confrontation over whether somebody, whether homosexuality is a sin or whatever else it may be, and all these socialists are vying to get this person removed, and all this doublespeak within their documents and so on. And we've actually gone through an organization that used exactly the same thing, it's interesting to note. But when we get into the actual legislation and what is in fact coming, you can see a hand which is dictatorial in its nature. And here in Revelation chapter 13, notice in verse 11, it said, "I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke as a dragon." In other words, it looks one way, but it's not. There's something else. "And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and those that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of the miracles that he had power to do in the sight of the beast." We're looking at a religious leader. We're looking at a miracle-working religious leader. And this is prophesied to be what seems to pull Europe together. It is religion that will pull Europe together, and it's not Muslim religion. You're looking at so-called Christian religion. "Saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound with the sword and did live. And he had the power to give life to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." Now, is this saying, therefore, that the beast that had a wound with a sword, that there is going to be a wound within Europe? Again, be aware of what it says. He had a wound with a sword and did live. And it says, "And he caused all, both small, great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand and their foreheads, and that no man may buy or sell unless he has that mark, the name of the beast, or the number of his name." Now, the mark of the beast, we know very clearly, is determined through the actual commandments, his commandment keeping. And the only commandments dealing with that is the Sabbath. So something will cause Sabbath observance to be outlawed. Something will cause Sunday observance to come to the fore and be enforced. And when you're looking at compulsory IDs, ID cards being issued, we can see that there's another piece of legislation that is being laid down that would work along that line, which would go along that line. And when we see the dictatorial nature of much of this legislation, there's another one here where it says, "The Euro judges end human rights law for the press." Now, this is Monday, October the 18th. It says, "The European Court has quietly brushed aside 50 years of international case law in a landmark judgment on press freedom rules, on a press freedom ruling that Brussels does not have to comply with European human rights codes." Now, this was one article, and it says, "In a judgment with profound implications for civil liberties." Now, notice, it's a European court has done this. Remember what we just read earlier on, that the Constitution is worded in such a way that the only way that you can really find out what it's saying is that there's going to be legislation that has to be then decided by the courts. And the courts will then decide, and here is the decision. Here is one type of decision. "In a judgment with profound implications for civil liberties, Euro judges backed efforts by the European Commission to obtain the computers, address books, telephone records, and 1,000 pages of notes seized by Belgian police on EU instructions from Hans Martin Tillack, the former Brussels correspondent of Germany's Stern magazine. It's a test case of whether the European Court will adhere to the democratic freedoms and liberty and liberal principles that have upheld for the last half century by Europe's top rights watchdog, the non-EU Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, or whether it will pursue a more authoritarian line as it grows in power." Okay? Mr. Tillack had written a series of hard-hitting exposés on EU fraud and skullduggery, relying on inside sources. By obtaining his archive of investigative files, amassed over 5 years, the Commission can identify the key sources and burn a generation of EU whistleblowers. In other words, they make their ruling, they make their court ruling, They go in there, they seize the documents, they can find out who is on the inside giving this information to the Stern magazine, and they can silence them. Now, if that isn't dictatorial powers, I don't know what is. And that's all, that took place about, what, a week ago? Just over a week ago? Says, if it ruled in Connolly versus Commission in 2001 that the EU could curtail civil rights to defend the general interest of the communities. Now there's a document, the statement, which is ambiguous. It's kind of, it doesn't mean an awful lot. But then you get the courts, the European Court have quietly pushed aside all the legislation that protects the journalist and allows the journalist to go ahead and quote his source. And allows the European Commission to go in there and silence the source. You could curtail civil rights to defend the general interest of the communities where necessary, despite human rights case law clearly and repeatedly banning recourse to such sweeping powers. In theory, the European Court is obliged to defer to the Court of Human Rights as a higher authority in all areas of right protection. The Tillich and Connolly rulings offer the first evidence that European judges may create their own very different brand of civil rights laws. Now, the kind of thing also, you'd see the kind of creeping dictatorship. There's another article, October the 21st, and this, again, is coming from the British government. And the headline is, midwives are to ask, does your husband beat you? All pregnant women are to be asked by their doctors and midwives if they are being abused by their husbands or boyfriends, it was announced yesterday. The move, part of government plans to tackle domestic violence, so it sounds wonderful, part of government plans to tackle domestic violence, follows research showing that women are more likely to be subject to violence when they're pregnant. But critics condemn the plans as intrusive, bureaucratic, and say that doctors, midwives and health visitors should not be forced to ask such personal questions. Now again, when you see what has happened in dictatorial states, it goes right down into the very homes themselves. And that is the kind of thing that we're looking at, where a law has come in, whereby midwives have got to ask a certain question. And if they don't fill in the answer to the certain question, then they will be prosecuted. But you see what's happening. It's behind the scenes. We don't see it up there in the front. But it is taking place. It is actually occurring. And at the same time, what is also occurring, and I'm going to have to wind up fairly soon, is that in the Middle East, we're looking at something which is taking place that... you know, we should be watching very, very carefully indeed, and that is Yasser Arafat. It says on today's paper, it says, the PLO tries to calm the chaos as Arafat's era ends. It says, a feeble and tremulous Yasser Arafat arrived in Paris yesterday for treatment for a serious disease that seems certain to put an end to his long leadership of the Palestinian people. And there was confusion about the nature of his illness, but Israelis and Palestinians agreed that his departure appeared to mark the end of an era. Whatever will be, we are seeing Arafat being sidelined. Said the left-wing MP and former peace negotiator. And both sides predicted that the fading of Mr. Arafat from the scene that he's dominated 40 years would be the prelude to a period of confusion and instability with a strong possibility of interfactional violence. Now, as I say, we're in a time now, it is a monumental time, a very significant time in regard to the church, in regard to 19-year time cycles. We're coming, just approaching that, and at the same time we're seeing an uncertainty within the world that we must be aware of, and there's this uncertainty and this underlying uncertainty that is there. Now, just about a week or so ago, there was an article, where before this came out, about Mr. Arafat having, and it's interesting, if you go back and I remember very, very clearly, Mr. Armstrong had the opportunity to go ahead and meet Yasser Arafat. He refused, point blank. He would not meet him. Mr. Armstrong refused to meet Yasser Arafat. Mr. Arafat wanted to meet Mr. Armstrong, but Mr. Armstrong wouldn't meet him. Now, he met Saddam Hussein. What's his name? Anwar Sadat. Anwar Sadat. and Menachem Begin and various other leaders as well, but he would not meet Yasser Arafat, and what he stands for and everything that he stands for was despised by Mr. Armstrong. Now, at the same time, you've got the right-wing rabbis stirring up civil war over Gaza. It says Israel's justice minister has accused right-wing rabbis of fomenting civil war, saying they could face prosecution for urging soldiers to disobey orders to evict Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip. So you've got that going on at the same time. And you've got all this... let me just read you what, in fact... A headline about just over a week ago, it says, "Is Arafat big enough to stop being a roadblock to peace?" It says, "For all its shortcomings, Sharon's plan offers the only hope for progress and should be encouraged as part of a wider process. Sharon has vowed not to negotiate under fire. Instead, he is now withdrawing under fire. Military planners worry that Israel's deterrence will be undermined, that Gaza will become another South Lebanon, or worse, an Afghan-style failed state where enemies such as Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda could implant themselves. But Sharon is gambling that the prospect of chaos in Gaza frightens others even more than it does Israel. And Arafat fears losing control of Gaza to Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and even to his own lieutenants. Egypt is alarmed at the prospect of an Islamic statelet on its border. The Americans don't need any more unset in the Middle East." And now all of a sudden the one that was hanging on to power and giving a certain stability has suddenly been taken away. Ill. He says, "So while Sharon insists the withdrawal is unilateral, in reality there's a complex multilateral negotiation taking place to ensure the vacuum is filled by more responsible forces. Sharon may refuse to talk to Arafat, but their senior lieutenants are in constant touch." Now, if their senior lieutenants cannot keep control, and without Arafat there, they will not be able to keep control as they would with him there, because he was an icon. What is going to happen? As it said in the paper this morning, you're looking at a period of violence, of instability, of chaos. And it is important that we understand that just where we are, church-wise, and put all of these type of things into that context. We don't need to be afraid of it. We don't need to worry about it. These things have got to be. We've got to watch and realize that those that you lead into captivity are going to go into captivity themselves. It's not just captivity, which is literal physical captivity. It's mental captivity as well. And when we see this kind of nonsense going on all over the world, realize that these things must be. And what is very important, that we understand a different way, and we understand that different way thoroughly, and we're able to thoroughly, therefore, understand it and teach it in the future. That's what is vitally important to the entire world.